meningitis was 4 years earlier, when my parents and I came in from the campo for dinner and to watch a production of La Bohème at the Teatro Colón. It was a Monday, my third day in Argentina, and the city was bustling and energetic in a manner that felt reminiscent of New York, but was closer in appearance to a European city, with a mix of modern and old-world architecture, plazas, and numerous cafés. What made Buenos Aires visually different from New York, Paris, or Madrid, cities to which it was sometimes compared, was the unruly and slightly decaying juxtaposition of structures from all eras, from Art Nouveau shopping galleries to Art Deco apartment towers to modernist glass skyscrapers, with a few old Spanish colonial buildings also in the mix in the older sections of the city. And then, of course, there were the city's inhabitants, the sophisticated and proud porteños. Most porteños I passed on the street were fashionably, if not expensively, attired. How one presented oneself to the world, even if everyone was dressed alike in the latest trend, seemed to matter in this town. Women were slim and petite, and if under the age of 40, wore their hair long. The men, many in tailored suits, were trim and of medium height. I rarely saw a man with facial hair. People walked purposefully until they bumped into someone they knew, in which case an effusive greeting and perhaps a pause to catch up over an espresso in one of the city's ubiquitous cafés would often follow. Porteños always had places to go, important meetings, classes, errands to run. But when it came to friends and family, they had all the time in the world. They were fiercely loyal, and their warmth and generosity extended to foreigners who moved to Buenos Aires for work or school. My parents had brought these traits to New York and quickly became a beloved couple among their American friends. I made my way to the barrio of Caballito, where the School of Philosophy and Letters of the Universidad de Buenos Aires was located. Unlike many American colleges that housed different schools or departments on one main campus, the UBA buildings were scattered across the city. When I found the school, I paused to admire the graffiti adorning the building's facade. The lettering scrawled above the arched entrance, "Knowledge, good; ignorance, evil," reminded me of photos I had seen of spray-painted New York subway cars in the 70s. I also noticed the windows had bars, making the building look like a jailhouse. It was a cold afternoon, but the sun shone from directly above. Students walked in and out of the building, while others stood on the tree-lined sidewalk, chatting, smoking, textbooks open, comparing notes. Inside, the school's walls were a dingy yellow. Bulletin boards were covered with advertisements and announcements for student meetings, class discussions, lectures, tutors for hire, used books for sale, and the like. After making some calls, I knew I was in the right place. But having lost track of time meandering the streets like a tourist, I worried that I may have missed him. I glanced at my watch. His class would have finished about 10 minutes ago. I peeked inside a couple of empty classrooms with desks and chairs that would not look out of place in an antiques show. An older, distinguished man with a beard walked past me. A couple of students called him by his name, Professor Torres. I followed them and waited until the students left. Professor!
Yes?
He barely looked my way as he headed toward the exit. Do you have a moment?
Sorry, there's no more room in my class, he said, not breaking his stride.
I had read about Torres's affiliation with the Movida Madrileña, a countercultural movement that emerged after Generalísimo Francisco Franco, Spain's dictator for 35 years, died in 1975. When Torres eventually accepted a teaching position at UBA in the late 1980s, he rose to cult status among the students. His lectures had been standing room only for a decade.
I'm not interested in enrolling,
I explained when I caught up to him on the sidewalk.
Could I just have a word with you?
Please, ask my secretary for an appointment.
He held out his arm to hail a cab.
Good day, señorita.
A black and yellow Fiat taxi stopped, and he climbed into the back seat. My hand flew out to keep the car door from shutting.
Wait. Please. I really need to talk to you now. I'm Santiago Larrea's daughter.
The taxi took us to the oldest café in the city, Café Tortoni, a Parisian-inspired establishment on Avenida de Mayo that retained its original beveled mirrors and stained glass ceiling. It was legendary among the country's literati. Busts of literary greats were on display, and as we were shown to a small table by a window, the professor pointed out the table that Jorge Luis Borges had regularly occupied. As we waited for our server, he explained that city planners had initially envisioned Avenida de Mayo as a Parisian-style boulevard, but it eventually turned into an area more closely tied to Madrid, with Spanish cafés, restaurants, and theaters. A waiter in a short tuxedo jacket approached our table, and Professor Torres motioned to me to order first. I hesitated, looking at the menu.
Una lágrima de café, por favor.
Professor Torres ordered for himself, a teardrop of coffee. When I gave him a curious look, he explained.
It's the opposite of a cortado. Instead of an espresso with a shot of hot milk, the lágrima is hot milk with only a few drops of espresso.
Sounds good. I'll have that too, please. The professor held up two fingers to the waiter.
Son dos lágrimas.
From his coat, he pulled out a pack of cigarettes and offered me one before lighting one for himself. He shared a couple more historical details about the café and the neighborhood until the waiter returned with our coffees, along with a dish of bite-sized cookies and two small glasses of sparkling water. Except for the note I found in my father's coat, I told the professor everything, starting from the beginning. How I met Grace Diaz de Graf in New York, and how that encounter led to my finding out about the safe house. The professor smoked while he listened, occasionally stroking his neatly trimmed goatee.
I met your father soon after my roommate, Gonzalo, was taken, he began. They wanted me too, but I had just gone upstairs to our neighbors.
Why did they come for you?
Well, let me see. Gonzalo was a painter, and I was a student of literature.
He clasped his hands under his chin.
You bring an artist and a graduate student together, and they become a fantastically dangerous pair.
But from what I understand, the military was fighting against terrorists and insurgents who bombed public buildings or killed innocent people. Only after the words left my mouth did I realize that he and his roommate might well have been involved in such subversive activities.
By the time of the coup in 1976, the AAA, a clandestine group of military police and goons created under Perón, had essentially killed off all the real urban guerrilla groups. There was no one else to target, so the military went after anyone they pleased. Some were in politics. Some were activists denouncing government corruption. Some were lawyers representing families whose loved ones had been illegally detained or disappeared without a trace. Many were students who took classes that were deemed suspect, like history, art, philosophy, sociology, literature, or journalism. If you were gay or a Jew, you were a target. It didn't matter what you believed in or did for a living. Others were disappeared for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. What distinguished the military rule from the time of Perón's government was that by then they had perfected the system for disappearing people.
He fell quiet for a moment.
A friend of Gonzalo's put me in touch with your father. He helped me get out of the country. I lived in Madrid for the next 10 years of my life and did not set foot in this country again until 1986.
As the waiter cleared our cups, the professor signaled for another lágrima.
I have a pre-ulcer condition, and the lágrima is gentler on my stomach, he told me,
though I hadn't inquired. When the waiter left, I asked, How old were you when you had to leave Argentina?
24.
He extinguished the cigarette and then looked right at me.
How old are you?
21. I watched him light another cigarette and thought that the chain smoking couldn't possibly be any good for his ulcer. As if he had read my mind, he eyed the cigarette and then said with a sheepish smile,
These are harder to give up.
The waiter brought more water and the lagrima and tucked another small receipt under the sugar bowl. The professor continued.
After the military government resigned and democratic elections were held again in 1983, we have the British to thank for defeating Argentina in the Malvinas, or the Falklands, as the English call them. Raúl Alfonsín was elected president and we were all free to return. Many decided to stay in their adopted countries. Those who came back to Argentina soon understood that living in exile had changed them in ways they hadn't foreseen. They would remain foreigners when they returned to their homeland.
One of his former students stopped by our table to say hello. When he left, I said,
Professor Torres, I have to admit that I'm having trouble reconciling the father I know with the one who risked his life for strangers.
You don't know what people are really made of until they find themselves in extreme circumstances.
He dropped a sugar cube into his coffee and stirred.
Some of us who passed through the safe house heard about a woman he had known. It was rumored that he built the safe house because of her.
Do you know anything else about her?
I never learned her real name, but I remember that she was an architect. Soon after President Alfonsín took office in 1983, he asked the writer Ernesto Sabato to preside over the National Commission on the Disappearance of Persons, CONADEP. The commission eventually published Nunca Más, Never Again, a book of testimonies by the survivors. She might have been interviewed for the report. If she didn't survive, she may be mentioned if someone saw her at one of the detention camps. You could also try the Human Rights Center. They keep files on people who were persecuted and on most of the desaparecidos.
From the porcelain tray, he selected a miniature meringue.
You take away these small pleasures from an old man, and what's left for him?
He let the sugary confection melt on his tongue before talking again.
Some trials were held under the new government, and it looked for a while like there would actually be repercussions for the perpetrators. But when Carlos Menem was elected president in 1989, he needed the support of the military and granted them amnesty.
Full amnesty? They're free to come and go as they please? It seemed unthinkable to me.
Correct. There were hundreds of torturers, and they're still among us. They're in the Secret Service. Many are our police officers, or they work as bodyguards. A few have gone into politics. Look at Aldo Rico. Pardoned for his crimes against humanity in 1989, he went on to be mayor of San Miguel. And now the governor of Buenos Aires wants to appoint him minister of police.
He shook his head. Did you ever find out what happened to your roommate? I asked.
No,
he replied with a sad smile. Martin Torres didn't tell me at the time that he had never been able to write about Gonzalo. In fact, he could not bring himself to read the book, Never Again. In this, I would later learn from others, the professor was not alone. The professor caught the waiter's eye and signaled for the check. He put away his cigarettes as the waiter tallied the bills left under the sugar bowl. When the final sum was announced, the professor handed over a few pesos.
I appreciate your taking the time to meet with me, I said, as he put on his overcoat and took his briefcase.
He held out his hand to me.
Please, thank your father for me. I never really got the chance.
Abuelo's maid had come to the apartment while I was out, leaving food in the fridge that only needed reheating. I arranged crackers, cheese, and ham on a plate, poured myself a glass of Coke, and went into the living room. Here, like at the campo, the furniture seemed to have faded with my grandmother's death. The white leather sofas had lost their luster, and the plush area rugs showed signs of old stains. What remained the same was the splendid view of the Rio de la Plata. The apartment was on the top floor, and one could see, beyond the shorter buildings, an endless expanse of water. Named the River of Silver by Portuguese and Spanish conquistadores, it was a muddy estuary between Argentina and Uruguay. That night, the river sparkled as if glitter had been sprinkled across its smooth surface. I flipped through a stack of old vinyl albums. Boleros, jazz vocalists, Brazilian sambas, music my father had grown up with and had introduced me to in New York. I picked out an album, Libertango, by Astor Piazzolla, and switched on the record player. The tango composer had spent his childhood in New York.
"Just like another Argentine kid I know," my father had often pointed out to me, smiling.
On any rainy weekend day, Dad would shut himself in the library and listen to this sensuous and often melancholy Argentine music. As a child, I would sit by the closed door to hear him softly sing the melancholy lyrics and wonder what was making him so sad. I thought about Sanchez's and Professor Torres's accounts. Dad had built the safe house for a reason. A missing woman. If that was the case, it might explain why he kept the safe house a secret from my mother. I walked into his old bedroom. His bookshelves held a few old high school and law textbooks mixed in among classics. Martin Fierro, Jules Verne, Victor Hugo. I ran my fingers along the old spines. I noticed a slim book wedged between two volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Martin Torres was written on the spine. I pulled it out and read the title, Death by Exile. On the back cover, a black and white photo showed a young, beardless Torres. I moved to the bed and, resting my head on a couple of pillows, opened the book. Some photos spilled out. In the first picture, I recognized my father, probably in his early 20s. He was on a beach with a woman who had her arms around his waist. They were both smiling at each other. Windswept dark curls partially hid the woman's tanned face, and she was significantly shorter than my father. Not my mother. The next photo showed my parents at El Pinar. Seated with them at the picnic table were a man and two women. The first woman was the same one from the beach. The second woman, in glasses, was Grace Diaz. A younger Sanchez stood behind the seated group, holding a large wooden platter piled with grilled meats. A third picture showed the woman from the beach. This time she was standing between my dad and the man from the photo at the ranch. The three were in front of what appeared to be a university building. I flipped it over and found an inscription. Dear Santiago, all's fair in love and war. Your friend, Maximo. I returned to the first photo and re-examined it, narrowing in on the pendant around the woman's neck. It looked familiar. I went to my father's desk and rummaged through the drawers until I found what I was looking for in the bottom one, a wooden box. One evening, when I was a child and my parents had gone out for the night, I'd snuck into my father's old bedroom and inspected his desk, coming across this box with his keepsakes. Once again now, I removed the lid and sifted through the old items. A Mont Blanc pen, a starched white bow tie, a stack of postcards from my uncle to my father. On the back of a postcard of the Spanish Steps in Rome, my uncle Bautista wrote how the city reminded him of Buenos Aires, except that the women were not as beautiful. As I took the remaining cards out from the box, I spotted it. A bit of leather cord poking out from under a tarnished whiskey flask. It was the necklace from the photo. The cord frayed and discolored with age, but the stone still a profound blue. Two letters were etched on the back. VQ. I turned the pendant over in my hand, feeling once again like the sleuth who had first discovered this treasure trove half a lifetime ago. Chapter 10. November. 1973. The sun's afternoon light slanted through the kitchen windows of Casa de los Niños. Located in a humble neighborhood outside the capital, it was a Catholic charity's daycare center where the nuns looked after preschoolers during the day, as well as older children who came after school for a snack and activities. Unofficially, it served as a soup kitchen for adults. Parents, dropping off their youngest children before going to work, were invited to breakfast, often their one and only solid meal of the day. Valentina, and Sister Alice Duvernay, a French nun who had recently moved to Buenos Aires, were preparing snacks. Today, the children would eat sliced apples and bread with a butter and sugar spread. When the final plate was done, Valentina removed her apron.
"Are you sure?"
"You go on now. We'll manage," Sister Alice reassured her.
The kitchen door opened, and Carmen, a Casa de los Niños volunteer who was also working toward her social work degree, came in to get more of the snacks. Valentina glanced into the large multi-purpose room.
The other two nuns were settling the children, 60 of them today, at the long wooden tables.
"Thank you. I'm sorry to leave early, but I promised Santiago I'd go to a gathering at his family's house."
He had offered to pick her up, but he had already made a trip to the airport earlier that day to meet his brother. She would take the bus.
"Is he your boyfriend now?" Carmen asked.
"I told you we don't need anything official. It's such an antiquated notion to begin with. But I am meeting his parents and his brother," Valentina said, smiling, in spite of the spike of anxiety she felt at the thought of being introduced to the Larreas all at once.
"Well, you look beautiful," said Sister Alice.
The nun's arms stretched out toward Valentina's outfit, a sky-blue cotton dress that was belted at the waist. It was one of several dresses her mother had sewn for her before she moved to the capital. Her hand reached behind and unclipped a barrette, letting her hair tumble around her long, tanned face.
"Can we make you a little prettier?"
Carmen extracted a lipstick from her pocket. Valentina shook her head and grabbed her purse hanging on a hook.
"A little blush, then?"
"No, thanks,"
Valentina replied cheerily. She didn't wear makeup. Didn't feel the need to.
"Take me as I am," her face announced to the world. It was one of the many things Santiago loved about her.
"Good luck,"
Carmen said, as Valentina kissed both women goodbye. It was early evening and still hot. As she walked along the dirt road to the bus stop, small clouds of dust rose up behind her heels. Valentina thought of the distances the children traveled on foot every day for a meal. By the time they returned home, they were hungry again. Whenever she could, she accompanied the smaller ones whose parents were at work and couldn't pick them up. Seeing some of their living conditions, half-built brick walls, mud floors, tin roofs, lack of running water or electricity or both, reinforced her conviction to continue her work providing proper homes for these families. After an hour-long bus ride, she entered Santiago's building, admiring the figures of cherubs cast into the plaster and the ornate walls embellished with motifs of fleur-de-lis. A few seconds in the lobby was enough to remind Valentina that she was once again stepping into a universe different from the one where homes were made of tin. Yet, since meeting Santiago, moving between these worlds had become almost effortless. Valentina felt light, floating like a balloon just high enough above the injustices she witnessed in her volunteer work. Her love for Santiago had expanded in all directions and renewed her sense of hope. One day, she was sure, they would live in a society where human misery could be eliminated. Communities would come together, putting their differences aside to build a better place for their children. Waiting for the elevator, Valentina thought of the night they met at Enrique Medina's apartment. Santiago had told her he knew they were meant for one another as soon as he laid eyes on her. Every moment with him, the way he touched her, the way he made her feel, was sweetly intoxicating. She had never felt so loved by a man and sometimes wondered if she would wake up to find it had been a dream. The elevator stopped on the Larreas' floor. Antonia, the family housekeeper, showed her inside.
A man resembling Santiago, but not as tall or slim, was talking to several guests.
He approached her.
"Hi, are you Valentina?"
"Yes. How did you guess?"
"My brother described you, and I can see he wasn't exaggerating."
His admiring gaze told her he liked the look of her.
"I'm Bautista. It's a pleasure."
He turned to the men hovering around the guest of honor.
"Meet some friends."
They each kissed her cheek. One of them said he was Sebastián Díaz.
Are you Grace's brother? She asked.
Yes. You know her?
I met her through Santiago.
She's in there.
Sebastian pointed to the living room.
But don't let my sister corrupt you with her recent obsession with student politics. God knows where she gets it from.
From the university. There's been an infiltration of communists among the faculty and students.
A blonde man standing behind Bautista said with quiet authority. Bautista swiveled around. He had forgotten this particular guest.
And this here is Pedro Garcia, he said.
The man gave her a slight nod as their host spoke on.
Our old classmate is in civilian clothes, but don't let that fool you. He just graduated from the Naval Academy.
Valentina managed to keep her voice neutral when she wished him congratulations. Pedro smiled a thank you, and the dark mole above his lip caught her attention. He noticed, and quickly raised a cocktail napkin to his mouth, as if to blot out the one imperfection on his otherwise unblemished face.
Hey, there you are, my love.
Santiago had entered the foyer. He kissed her.
Have these guys been bothering you? I wouldn't trust a single one of them alone with you,
he joked, while casting a dubious glance at the group. The men, who had been Bautista's classmates at an elite private school and still thought of Santiago as the baby brother, laughed, raising their palms to show they had no bad intentions.
Just getting to know your friend. She's lovely, Bautista answered.
His smile was genuine.
They've made me feel very welcome, Santiago.
Good, he said, but he put a firm arm around her as though to protect her from other potential cads in the area.
Santiago had said it would be a small welcome gathering for his brother. By the number of people in the apartment, Valentina would have said it was a party. She glanced about the living room. The women her age were dressed in bell-bottoms, flimsy camisoles, tank tops, clogs, and platform sandals. Men, some sporting sideburns or mustaches, wore short-sleeved shirts and high-waisted jeans. The guests of his parents' generation were more formally attired, the gentlemen unruffled by the heat, in double-breasted suits, and the ladies in fitted tops and skirts or slacks with matching shoes and sparkling jewelry. The matronly types wore their short hair brushed back and teased, in the style of Isabelita, although these women would not have appreciated the comparison. Guests were seated on white sofas, arranged around a low marble coffee table on a Persian rug. Two sizable oil paintings of horseback riders in rural settings adorned one of the cream-colored walls, opposing the enormous windows. The curtains pooled luxuriously on the parquet floor, drawn so that family and guests could enjoy the magnificent views of the Rio de la Plata. At the other end of the living room, guests sat on soft leather chairs, placed around a backgammon table. Santiago directed her to a drop-leaf bar cart positioned next to the wall and poured each of them a glass of champagne. Grace came over and hugged Valentina.
Where's Maximo? Asked Santiago.
He had something going on last minute. We'll meet him at the concert, Grace said.
Santiago was cornered by some of his parents' friends, while Grace was monopolized by two girlfriends from her high school.
All at once, Valentina was alone.
She smiled pleasantly at no one, trying to appear at ease. A waiter offered her a cocktail-sized crustless sandwich, and, grateful for something to do, she thanked him. Valentina thought of Maximo. He was close to Grace and Santiago, but had, on more than one occasion, criticized the upper classes from which they came. Had he intentionally made other plans so as to avoid attending the gathering? An elderly gentleman in a three-piece suit began making small talk with Valentina, asking her name and, when he heard her accent, where she was from. She had to repeat herself and wondered if his hearing aid was turned off. Right when she was starting to regret taking off early from the daycare, wondering why on earth she was at this stuffy party, she glimpsed Santiago. He was looking right at her, smiling while his eyes widened in mock alarm. His great aunts, two diminutive sisters indistinguishable from each other in their matching sweater sets, had latched onto his arms,
remarking how handsome he had grown to be from the skinny young boy they remembered so well. He mouthed the words, "I have not forgotten you. Give me one more minute." When they were able to extricate themselves from the octogenarian set, they migrated into the dining room. From the high ceiling, a glittering chandelier hung over a large oval table laden with finger sandwiches and sweets. Santiago took her hand and led her across the room.
"Mama, meet Valentina."
"Mrs. Larrea, how do you do?"
Constanza Larrea shifted in her seat to assess the guest. The only item of note on the woman dangled from a leather cord around her neck, a deep blue stone with glimmering diamond chips. Constanza's eyes moved imperceptibly between her son and Valentina. How close they stood side by side, as if they were familiar on an intimate level. This possibility perturbed her. Santiago didn't discuss his dalliances with his parents, and this was fine. Except for now. Constanza had the sudden urge to find out whatever happened to Mercedes, the daughter of their friend, General Delgado. Why had Santiago stopped dating her? She thought Mercedes was a perfectly darling young woman.
"Please, call me Constanza."
She remained seated, but did tilt her cheek up for Valentina to kiss. Constanza Larrea's salon-lightened hair was brushed away from her face and swept upward in curls above her shoulders. Her white linen dress and perfume were expensive but tasteful. She was a beautiful woman who preserved her aging looks with grace.
"So, you are a friend of Santiago's from university?"
"That's right," Valentina said. "We're dating, Mama."
"Nonsense. Too young, all of you, to get serious. I wish I had waited. I should have had more fun, given a chance to some of the other suitors calling at my father's door."
Constanza smiled then, and looked toward an older, elegant man with thick, wavy hair, now gone silver, standing in a corner with other guests.
"But I didn't do too badly. Have you met my husband and my son, Bautista?"
"I met Bautista when I arrived. You must be overjoyed to have him home."
"Naturally. His visits are never long enough. They never are for a mother."
"It must be hard having him away so often."
"It is,"
Constanza replied, and regarded Valentina's face.
"Where's your accent from? Are you from the interior?"
"Córdoba."
"Ah, Córdoba. I went once, when my mother's health was failing. My father took the family to a spa in the hills. I was small, and I remember it being incredibly quiet.
The silence was awful.
It was probably my father's or the doctor's orders for us children to be quiet around my mother. Years later, my therapist told me that I associate Córdoba with my mother's death,"
Constanza said, waving her manicured hand as if the depressing subject she herself had started wasn't appropriate cocktail chatter.
"Anyway," she said, to change the topic, "I've never been back."
"Córdoba City is lively," Valentina offered, but Santiago's mother was not listening.
Her focus had moved to her husband, who was coming toward them.
"Papa, this is Valentina," said Santiago.
Alfonso paused to consider the woman before him. He then gave her a feathery kiss on the cheek.
"Son, I commend you. You're always in the company of striking young ladies,"
Alfonso remarked with a smile at Valentina, as if this should be taken as a compliment. A priest had joined them at Alfonso's side.
"Constanza, Father Aznar wants to say hello."
Mrs. Larrea rose.
"Father, thank you for gracing us with your presence," Constanza said.
The priest clasped her hands and, as if they were in a confessional,
began to speak to Santiago's parents in hushed tones. Santiago and Valentina took the opportunity to drift back into the living room.
"Are you guys ready?" Grace asked.
"Maximo is meeting us soon at the music venue."
"We'll be with you in a minute," Santiago said, glancing at Valentina.
When Grace left, he asked,
"Everything okay?"
"Not sure. I need a moment to recover."
"From what? Meeting my parents?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Why? You didn't really get to talk to my father. But my mother, she likes you."
"You think so?"
Valentina couldn't shake the feeling that the opposite was true.
"She shared a personal story with you."
"A story about how much she dislikes the place I come from."
"I wouldn't say that. It's a story I hadn't heard before, and she felt she could share it with you. She must have seen in you what I see."
Valentina raised her eyebrows. "And what's that?" His hands framed her face.
"That you're a beautiful person. Open and pure. You're someone people can trust."
Valentina had seen it differently. Constanza purposefully, if indirectly, had let Valentina know that she didn't like her. She didn't, however, share this opinion with Santiago because he was now kissing her. He murmured into her ear,
"You make people want to tell you their deepest secrets."
Even with his parents in the next room, his kiss excited her. She wanted more, but she broke away.
"And your father? He practically compared me to a woman in his son's harem," Valentina said, making a face.
"Sorry. He was just trying to be charming. What can I say? He's of another generation. It probably wasn't the best time to meet them, but you didn't want any formal presentations, right?"
She nodded. His arms closed around her. And when he whispered,
"Give them time,"
she knew she would. Chapter 11. August 1998. The fluorescent lighting and institutional green walls of the Human Rights Center reminded me of the decor of the University of Buenos Aires, and not in a good way. I hesitated outside a frosted glass door with etched lettering that read, "Administrative Office." A woman on the phone sat at a desk behind the counter. Posters covered the office like wallpaper. The largest one was a montage of black and white headshots. Most of the people were in their 20s and wore serious expressions. On the wall to my left was an Amnesty International poster reading, "We can change what they do," in thick black letters against a canary yellow backdrop. On the back wall, a poster announced a march to protest the appointment of Lieutenant Colonel Aldo Rico as head of the police force. The words, "Human rights abuser," appeared below the soldier's face in war paint. Boxes sat unopened on the floor, and piles of books rested on a narrow table, lending a confined feeling to the small space. When the woman hung up, she shuffled some papers before looking up at me.
"Can I help you?"
"Please," I said, setting down my bag and notebook on the counter. "I'm looking for information on a desaparecida."
"Are you a relative?"
No, I stammered. I'm a college student, visiting from the United States. I'm doing a research paper on the writer Martin Torres, and when I met with him the other day, he said that you might be able to help me. There's a woman he mentioned who was abducted."
"Sorry, but we can't just let anyone have access to the files. You have to present us with a letter from your university explaining who you are and the purpose of your research."
The phone rang. "I see," I said. "Thank you." The receptionist gave me a brief smile before picking up the phone. I left the office. How could I have thought that the staff at the center would simply hand over files to me? I had met with Professor Torres the day before, and had I been thinking clearly, I could have asked him to arrange access for me. Displeased with myself, I exited the building. Now I had plenty of time to return to the apartment and get changed for my date with Juan.
but then I realized I had left my notebook behind. Preparing to apologize for bothering the receptionist again, I hurried back to the office. It was empty. I peeked out and glimpsed the woman at the other end of the corridor, chatting with a colleague. She followed him into an office. Grabbing my notebook from the counter, I noticed that the door next to the receptionist's desk had been left ajar. Curious, I walked around the counter to take a look. It was a small room full of file cabinets. Without a second thought, I stepped inside and shut the door behind me. After a few deep breaths, I peeled myself off the door. If I didn't want to get caught, I would have to work fast. The drawers were arranged alphabetically, and I opened the one labeled with the letters P and Q. Good. This should be quick, I told myself. I'll be out of here before she comes back. I began rifling hastily through the folders, but as my eyes landed on bits and pieces of images and words, I found myself slowing down. One photo showed a cell the size of a broom closet with blood-stained walls. Another one depicted a young man holding a soccer ball, grinning into the camera. A young couple on their wedding day, broad smiles on their faces, excited about their future. One victim's account of her capture gave a detailed description of the different forms of torture she'd undergone, including one method known as the submarine, in which her head was repeatedly submerged in a bathtub until she would nearly drown. Another victim described having his limbs splayed out and bound to a table and receiving currents of electricity to his underarms and testicles. I snapped the folder shut. This visceral reaction surprised me. Up until now, I had approached the investigation as if I were writing a history paper for one of my classes. Words like victims, kidnapped, tortured, exiled, survivors, and missing had remained in the realm of the abstract. Yet, in skimming the files, I began to feel a strange connection to the stories. I paused and took a deep breath. Don't let your imagination get the better of you. Hurry! You don't have much time. The file labeled Q contained fewer folders than P. I sifted through them until I came across a file that made me stop. Inside the folder was a 4x4-inch black-and-white headshot of a woman, her profile at a three-quarters angle. A passport photo? From my purse, I pulled out my dad's photos and compared them to the one in the file. The picture from the ranch was the most helpful, because the brunette was looking right at the camera. The same thick ringlets falling around an angular face, and those eyes that projected earnestness. My hand trembled slightly as I took out the form and looked for the person's name. Valentina Quintero. VQ, like the letters etched on the back of the pendant. It's her. The file revealed the following information. Valentina Quintero, daughter of Antonio Quintero, deceased 1985, and Maria Elvira Lopez de Quintero, deceased 1987. Date and place of birth? Córdoba City, province of Córdoba. September 25, 1952. Profession? Architect. Volunteer at Casa de los Niños, a children's daycare center. Another name appeared in the file. José Rivera, the superintendent of the building where Valentina Quintero rented a studio. He was the last person to see her before her disappearance in April 1976. Chapter 12. January 1974. Christmas came and went, and the new year announced itself by rolling over Buenos Aires with its hot, humid blanket of summer. As lethargic as the city's inhabitants were in their movements, the opposite was true for some members of the armed branch of the Communist Party, who had nimbly robbed weapons from an armory. President Perón donned a military uniform for a nationally televised speech in which he criticized the governor of Buenos Aires for not coming down harder on terrorist elements and called on the nation to annihilate this criminal terrorism as soon as possible. The governor was left with no alternative but to resign,
making way for one of Perón's right-wing men to step in as governor and carry out the president's orders. The oppressive heat and news followed Santiago on the 3-hour ferry trip across the Rio de la Plata, but receded when he arrived on the Atlantic beaches of Punta del Este, Uruguay, where his family had a house. He rang in the new year without Valentina, who had gone home to Córdoba when classes were over in December. Her mother, a seamstress, had a small shop and needed her daughter's help. Her assistant was on maternity leave. But Valentina had asked Santiago, along with Máximo and Grace, to meet her at a popular music festival to be held in Cosquín, Córdoba province, later in January. One night, after dinner with Bautista and some of his friends, Santiago joined a large crew heading out to dance. Punta del Este's nightlife revolved around casinos and nightclubs and was likened to that of Monaco or Saint-Tropez.
"If you're here alone, then it means you're alone," argued a woman he recognized from law school when he politely rejected her advances. A friend of Bautista's, a tall, young German woman, told him,
"Your girlfriend sounds more attractive than you. I'd like to meet her."
That got a laugh out of him, but when he left the nightclub, he felt agitated. Back at his family's beach house, in the chic neighborhood of La Barra, on the north side of the resort, he lay in bed, wide awake. He missed Valentina's smile, her attentive eyes while she listened to his most intimate thoughts, her lush brown curls, the way she chewed on a pencil, jotting notes or underlining passages in the books she read, how sometimes she snorted when laughing. He loved making her laugh. He loved making love to her. He took the ferry back to Buenos Aires the next morning and looked into flights to Córdoba City. When the travel agent informed him that the earliest available flight was at the end of the week, he decided to drive. Excited by this new plan, Santiago dialed the number she had given him from a phone booth. No one picked up the phone. What to do? She hadn't given him her home address, but she had mentioned the name of her neighborhood. He also remembered the name of her mother's shop, Quintero Costuras. Easy. Enough to go on. He would find her. It was an 8-hour drive to Córdoba, but he made it in 7. Santiago thought he would get pulled over for speeding, and he had cash ready for the standard bribe. Driving through the foothills where the Córdoba mountains meet the Pampas plains, he wasn't stopped once. Unaware that the police force's attention had shifted from petty violations to matters of a secret and sinister nature, Santiago considered himself one lucky driver. It was his first time in Córdoba City, and its rich Spanish architecture was evident in the cathedral, the buildings of the local university, the viceroy's palace, the fountains, and the monument to General José de San Martín, the liberator of Argentina, Chile, and Peru. Santiago stopped at a pharmacy and purchased tokens to use a payphone. He tried again the number Valentina had given him, letting it ring a few times before hanging up. As he drove away from downtown, he was forced to ask for directions when his map failed him. The Quinteros' neighborhood was on the western edge of the city. After he checked into the only hotel in the area, he went out to look for the shop. He walked past small houses with lovely flower boxes hanging from windows. He whistled, content to be in the neighborhood where Valentina had grown up. When he found Quintero Costuras, it was closed, even though it was only early evening. Puzzled, he shook the shuttered iron grate until he heard the sounds of someone unlocking the metal door.
"Santiago!"
Valentina's eyes widened with surprise. She kissed him hurriedly and brought him inside.
"I was supposed to meet you in Cosquín in 2 days.
"I couldn't wait," he said, and kissed her again.
The space was small but strategically arranged. By the entrance were a sofa and a chair for clients. Fashion magazines were displayed on a small rack. 2 sewing machines and patterns rested on large tables. Spools of thread were organized like a rainbow and kept in long glass boxes. There was a bathroom, a kitchenette, and a back door leading to a garden. On one wall, a thick velvet curtain hung on a curved rod, allowing a client to change in private. The opposite wall was covered in a thick sheet, with buttons pinned to it. Their range in shape, size, and color made for a beautiful mural. Mannequins were draped in partially sewn dresses and men's suits. A large calendar hung behind a desk, with dates circled for fittings. More than a seamstress's shop, it had the feel of an artist's workshop.
Are you alone?
Where's your mom?
She left. My parents' friend was found dead earlier today.
What happened?
He was kidnapped in front of his home a week ago. He was pushing for a raise in transportation salaries.
And they killed him for that?
Probably, she said, biting her lip. His body was dumped in a landfill. My parents left, and I stayed behind to close the shop.
The people of Córdoba did not know of the police activities being plotted at the local and federal level, activities that were already playing out in the illegal detention and treatment of its citizens. Perón had accused Córdoba, an automotive manufacturing center, of being infected with Marxist infiltrators. This condemnation would lead to a historical day of violence a month later that would upend the province, with union syndicates attacked, bombs detonated in the homes of public officials, and hundreds detained, including the governor, in the first ever police takeover of a provincial government. The abduction and brutal death of the Quinteros' family friend would be the first of many.
Valentina fluttered about as she spoke, turning off the sewing machines, straightening out the desk, folding scraps of fabric into drawers. When she was done, she asked, "Can you drive me to their house?"
"I left the car at the hotel."
"I'll take the bus then," she said, turning off the lights and opening the door for them to leave.
"Let me go with you," he said.
"I don't think it's a good idea. Where are you staying? I'll meet you there."
By the time she showed up at his hotel room, it was long after midnight, and Santiago had fallen asleep waiting for her. He was drowsy when he opened the door, but she was ready for him. They hurriedly undressed while kissing each other everywhere. The wait was over, and getting under the sheets, they finally rested in each other's arms. Santiago nestled his head between her breasts.
"Did you miss me?"
he asked.
"Very much. Couldn't you tell?"
"I was miserable without you," he said.
He had never been this honest with anyone. With her, he didn't need to hold anything back, be someone he wasn't.
"I missed you and thought of you all the time, too. But I've also been incredibly busy. I think my mother is hoping I'll transfer back to school here. She could use my help, especially if her employee decides to stay home with the baby."
He lifted his head up.
"You wouldn't dare."
"Tranquilo. Of course I won't. I love Buenos Aires. I want to make my time there last as long as possible."
"And me? What about me?"
he asked in a teasing tone, though it was a serious question.
"Silly.
I love you more than I love Buenos Aires."
They kissed and rested comfortably in silence until Santiago spoke again.
"Can I come to your house tomorrow?"
"Oh, Santi."
She kissed the tip of his nose.
"The timing isn't good. It's better that my parents not know about your visit. There's too much going on. You understand, no?"
Valentina had told him her parents were socially conservative when it came to their daughter, but he had expected to meet them. During his drive, he had had time to imagine their first encounter. He would arrive at their house with flowers and chocolates, a bottle of scotch for her father. They would invite him in for an asado or a tea. He would charm them and show them he was the right man for Valentina. Looking at her, he understood that she hadn't told her parents about him.
"It could be a quick visit, to introduce myself, for them to meet the man you're dating. I won't even hold your hand in their presence."
He moved to the end of the narrow bed so that their bodies weren't touching.
"See? I'm very capable of keeping my hands off you."
Smiling at his clownish behavior, she nevertheless said,
"It's not the right time, Santiago."
His face soured.
"Stay tomorrow, and we'll go to Cosquín the day after.
I'll tell them I'm going with some of my friends. But it'll be just you and me.
And Maximo and Grace and Enrique, Santiago thought.
She inched her way to him until their bodies were one. Their kiss was long, and then she got up to get dressed.
You'll meet them next time you come to Córdoba, she said,
and he nodded. Drunk with love, it could not possibly occur to either of them that such a time would never come. Chapter 13, August 1998. I was in the filing room of the Human Rights Center, copying down Valentina Quintero's address, when I heard a noise. Had the receptionist returned? As quietly as I could, I returned the folder to the file cabinet. My notebook was still in my hand when a young man stepped out from behind a cabinet. I let out a small yelp.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to scare you.
It's okay, I said. Collecting myself, I added, you almost gave me a heart attack.
I didn't expect anyone to be in here, he said. You surprised me, too.
He tilted his head.
Who are you? What are you doing in here? I'm doing research. A project related to Martin Torres. Rosanna let you in?
Who?
Oh, you mean the receptionist? Yeah, we spoke. She was very helpful. Martin Torres, you said? He's one of my favorites, up there with Paul Auster and José Donoso. I've been meaning to read Donoso. He's Chilean, right? And I should read Auster. Funny how he seems to have a bigger following outside of the U.S., even though he's American.
I needed to leave before Rosanna returned. He shifted his weight to one side, and I saw an opening between him and the door.
So you're a writer? He asked. Me?
I let out a short laugh.
No, I'm a reader, except for when it comes to, writing a school paper, like this one on Torres. I'm majoring in English, but who knows, maybe someday.
I inched toward the door.
I bet you write, don't you? You look like you could be a writer.
An incredibly dumb thing to say, but I was too nervous to think straight. I had to get out of there.
Well, I'm not. I'm in graduate school. Anthropology. That's cool.
I was almost at the door.
It looks like you're ready to leave.
I am.
Let me show you out, Ms.
I briefly considered giving him a false name.
Paloma. I'm Franco.
The receptionist was not yet back at her desk, and when we walked out into the hall, my shoulders untightened. I turned to say goodbye. Franco was about my height, and I guessed that he was probably a couple of years older than I was. He wore an old mustard-colored sweater with a hole in one elbow, brown corduroys, and a pair of beat-up red Adidas. His black, wavy hair fell just below his chin, and when he pushed his round, wire-rimmed glasses back up his nose, I saw that his eyes were a marine blue.
Where's home for you?
Franco asked.
New York.
A few young people waved to him as they walked by and entered a conference room down the hall.
Your Spanish is pretty good for a Shanky.
A man with a rugby player physique broke away from another incoming group and clapped Franco on the back.
Che, Mateo, what's going on?
Franco asked with a grin, returning the firm pat.
All good,
Mateo said, while also nodding hello to me. He wore a black t-shirt with an image of Che Guevara stretched across his massive frame. A woman in a brown leather jacket with navy blue streaks through her hair kissed both men hello.
Meeting starting,
she told them. Franco said he would be right there.
You should probably go, I said, when the door to the conference room closed.
Yeah, well, I hope you got everything you needed,
Franco said.
I did. Thank you.
Good luck with the research.
Thanks.
When he reached the conference room, he looked back.
I don't know if this would appeal to you, but we're having a meeting. It's for hijos.
He paused and smiled.
But I'm guessing you probably haven't heard of us all the way over in New York.
I haven't.
IJOS is an acronym for Hijos por la Identidad y la Justicia contra el Olvido y el Silencio.
Sons and Daughters for Identity and Justice Against Oblivion and Silence.
We are children of the desaparecidos, or people whose parents were political prisoners or lived in exile during the dictatorship.
I regarded him with renewed interest.
Do you want to sit in? Maybe it could be of some use to you for your project on Torres.
I glanced at my watch. Juan was waiting for me. I really couldn't stay. But when I looked back up at Franco, I decided I would. The room was filled with 20 people, ranging in age from 18 to 30 years old. They sat around the oval-shaped table or in fold-up chairs against the wall. Others were perched on the windowsill or leaning against a sideboard piled with books and magazines. A few had settled themselves on the carpeted floor. Franco brought me over to the burly man in the Che t-shirt.
Mateo, meet Paloma.
Mateo kissed my hand with old-fashioned gallantry. Beside them sat a man engrossed in a graphic novel.
Julian! This is Paloma.
A scrawny guy with prematurely gray hair stood to give me a quick kiss on the cheek. A middle-aged woman in a pale blue smock entered the room with a mate gourd and a large thermos. She flipped her frosted blonde hair back as she approached a man in a ponytail and a black t-shirt with the Rolling Stones logo of Mick Jagger's mouth. Franco explained.
Miriam works in the building. She takes care of us during our meetings.
A petite black-haired woman in gray slacks and a cardigan walked to the front of the room. She put a notebook on the table and faced the group. Franco murmured,
"That's Sofia. When she's not working for Hijos, she's an accountant."
Having Franco next to me, filling me in on who was who, made me feel less conspicuous. He would put his mouth close to my ear, and with each comment he made, I felt his minty breath on my cheek.
"I know some of you have to get back to work, school, or other things, so let's get started," Sofia said.
The room quieted down.
"And for those of you who attended the protest against Aldo Rico earlier today, a special thank you for coming."
After some orderly applause, Sofia turned to Julian, who hadn't looked up once from his book. He reached into his backpack and extracted a large cardboard tube.
"Here it is," Julian mumbled,
unrolling a large black-and-white image of a priest with bold letters underneath.
"Padre Reinaldo Aznar, assassin.
Turned over 23 of his parishioners to the military junta. All remain missing." The room was silent for a respectful moment before a few members of the group spoke up with design suggestions.
"I think the part about his parishioners should be in bigger type," suggested a guy with a guitar case slung across his back. "We should stamp assassin across his face," interjected a girl with two hoops pierced through her left nostril and eyes rimmed with thick black liner.
"Excellent ideas," said Sofia.
"Julian, why don't you put together a couple of different options and we'll make our final decision then.
How long do you need?"
"I could have them in a couple of days," Julian said in a near whisper.
"Once we approve the final design, we need to get it to the printers. Mateo, how many flyers?"